Now, Jesus is talking to the 70 disciples who had just come back from their first missionary tour. And here is what he says to them. He says, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." Now, when did this happen? When did Satan fall like lightning from heaven? Of course, we answer quickly, when he sinned and got kicked out of heaven. And no, here is the story of that. War broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Now that's the passage we usually think of to tell the story of how it all started. But notice when we make this connection, we are actually equating two different phrases. Jesus said that Satan fell, but here in Revelation 12, it says that he was cast out. And before we move along, please notice the Bible reference. It is Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 to 9. Okay, now the plot thickens slightly as we moved on to stage 2. Notice what Jesus said in this verse. "Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out." And the time here is just before the crucifixion. And we usually think of that as the time when Satan was cast out, the ruler of this world. So, does that mean that Revelation 12 is really talking about the crucifixion as well as his being cast out of heaven? Now, how does Ellen White use this text, Revelation chapter 12? "Christ bowed his head and died. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, 'Now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night.'" And guess what? That's Revelation chapter 12, verse 10. So why is Ellen White quoting that verse when she's talking about the crucifixion? Is it because the second casting down is even more important than the first casting out of heaven? The first casting out was just an exile. He was cast out of heaven. He could no longer be part of heaven. Stage 2 casting out or down is a loss of Satan's credibility, which is what the great controversy is all about. Who is telling the truth, God or Satan? All right? Maybe this will help. After the crucifixion, Satan saw that he had overreached himself. Satan saw that his disguise was torn away, that the character he had tried to fasten on Christ was fastened on himself. It was as if he had the second time fallen from heaven. And this is at the cross. If there is something about these two events, the fall of Satan in heaven and the death of Christ on the cross, that is so similar that inspired writers seem to put them all together, the first and the second casting out. And actually, Ellen White made the linkage even stronger here. God looked upon the victim expiring on the cross and said, "It is finished. The human race shall have another trial. The redemption price was paid. And Satan fell like lightning from heaven." So there you have stages 1 and 2 in the fall of Satan, being cast out of heaven and now being cast down at the time of Christ's death. So let's move on to stage 3. And yes, this does look familiar. It's Revelation chapter 12 again, and it really is stage 3. "The accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they did not love their lives to the death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time." Now let's look at this very carefully. Let's break this apart. "The accuser of our brethren has been cast down." That's at the death of Christ. Has been cast down. Now a new group is introduced. There is a group of people who have beaten the devil. They overcame him. And they placed their lives at risk in that process. They did and could suffer death. Now, because they overcame, that's what therefore means, the heavens and everyone who lives there can rejoice. But these events appear to be bad news for all those who live in the wrong places. And of course, the wrong place is us, because the devil is running out of time, and he's very angry about that. All right, let's look at this carefully. The accuser of our brethren has been cast down. A group of people have beaten the devil, placing their lives at risk in the process. And because they overcame, everyone in heaven rejoices. But everyone on earth or in the sea is in trouble because the devil is running out of time and he's really mad about it. All right, step back a little and tell me when all of this comes together in terms of time. And of course, you know, the end of time, the time in which we are living right now. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea. For the devil is come down unto you having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. Fearful are the scenes which call forth this exclamation from the heavenly voice. The wrath of Satan increases as his time grows short, and his work of deceit and destruction will reach its culmination in the time of trouble. And so, this passage in Revelation 12 is really talking about three different episodes that are taking place. We've got the fall of Satan 6,000 years ago. We've got the crucifixion, not quite 2,000 years ago. And we have the time of trouble, sometime in our future. So what's going on? What do these three events have in common? And here's a clue. Satan is an accuser of the brethren, and his accusing power is employed against those who work righteousness. The Lord desires through his people to answer Satan's charges by showing the results of obedience to right principles. So these three events are all based on Satan's accusations against Christ. He is saying Christ's way doesn't work. Now, after we add another couple of pieces to the puzzle, the picture will be clear. The completeness of Christian character is attained when the impulse to help and bless others springs constantly from within. It is the atmosphere of this love surrounding the soul of the believer that makes him a savor of life unto life. And of course, as we all know, answering Satan's charges involves much more than pure doctrine. Far more important are the lives that God's people live. Okay, now it's time for stage four. But first, we're going to go right back to where we started. And here we have the statement, which is reviewing stage two. Like the apostles, the 70 had received supernatural endowments as a seal of their mission. When their work was completed, they returned with joy, saying, Lord, even the devils are subject unto us through thy name. Jesus answered, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. And again, that is the stage two that we have been reviewing. The scenes of the past and the future were presented to the mind of Jesus. Really, past and future. He beheld Lucifer as he was first cast out from the heavenly places. And of course, that's reviewing stage one as Christ was presenting this. He looked forward to the scenes of his own agony when before all the worlds the character of the deceiver should be unveiled. He heard the cry, it is finished, announcing that the redemption of the lost race was forever made certain, that heaven was made eternally secure against the accusations, the deceptions, the pretensions that Satan would instigate. And of course, for Jesus, this was the near future, just ahead of him, what we called our stage two. Beyond the cross of Calvary, with its agony and shame, Jesus looked forward to the great final day when the prince of the power of the air will meet his destruction in the earth so long marred by his rebellion. Jesus beheld the work of evil forever ended and the peace of God filling heaven on earth. So this is stage four, the final destruction of sin and Satan. This is his last fall from heaven, and it's obviously still future. So stage three, here it comes. Henceforward, Christ's followers were to look upon Satan as a conquered foe. Upon the cross, Jesus was to gain the victory for them, that victory he desired them to accept as their own. That's it. Stage three. Isn't maybe as detailed as the others, but they're all there, stages one through four in the fall of Satan. And where did I find this little gem? Have you read Desire of Ages recently? This is so full of material to help us understand why we're here and what is going to happen in the future and how it will all end. So a quick recap. 6,000 years ago, the members of the Godhead understood Satan's plans and arguments and rejected them. 2,000 years ago, the angels and the unfallen worlds understood Satan's plans and arguments and rejected them. The near future, hopefully, the 144,000 will understand Satan's plans and arguments and will reject them. And then 1,000 years later, the wicked will understand Satan's plans and arguments and will reject them. Now, who's missing from this scenario? We've covered the 144,000 who will be translated. We've covered the wicked that will finally be destroyed. The righteous dead, what about them? What about the ones who die in the Lord? We'll come back to them in a little bit. So there, my friends, is the fall of Satan. It's a complicated business. It comes in four stages, and each one is crucially important. And naturally, it's easiest to understand the first two parts because they've already happened. But it's stage three that should interest us the most, because we actually have something to do with stage three. We act a part in this part of the whole plan, and we need to be really working on our place in the whole plan that God has set up. So let's focus on the last two parts right now. Basic points. This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. A very familiar verse. Everyone knows the order of events here. But today I'd like to ask if there is a reason for this statement, this order of events. It's a very common assumption that the gospel must go to all the world before the end will come. And as we work our way through this, we'll find that this assumption is correct. But do you know why this gospel has to go to all the world? Here's a hint. It isn't so that everyone will have a chance to be saved. Billions of people have already died without even hearing the gospel. And Zechariah and Paul talk about the unenlightened heathen who will actually find a way into heaven. So God has a way of dealing with that problem. So why does this gospel need to go to all the world? The problem is, which gospel is this gospel? If the Pope could preach an evangelistic series that was broadcast to every person on earth, would the end come? How about Benny Hinn, Pat Robertson, James Dobson, Joel Osteen, or Ted Wilson, Dwight Nelson, Doug Batchelor, Mark Finley? The point is, this gospel has to be complete, mature, and powerful enough to bring on the end. That's what the gospel needs to be, the real gospel. To whatever extent my gospel falls short of that, I will fall short of ever actually finishing God's work, no matter how much I do. You see, in the Lord's service, quality is much more important than quantity. Our failure, my failure to master the science of salvation is the greatest holdup in the great controversy today. And Scripture talks about that holdup in the Lord's plans. After these things, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, on the sea, or on any tree. Then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads." And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. So what's the holdup? The sealing is holding up God's plans till we have sealed the servants of our God. It's also holding up Satan. It's keeping him on this planet. He started falling a long time ago, and he should have hit the rocks by now. He should have been destroyed. It's only because we aren't ready, because I'm not ready for that sealing, that he's still doing serious damage on planet Earth. That is the holdup. But why? Why can't God's plans go forward without this sealing? What makes it necessary? What does it accomplish? To the intent that now the manifold wisdom of God might be made known by the church to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. Now notice it says, by the church. By the church. Somehow the church, that's people like you and me, will provide a demonstration of the manifold wisdom of God that is so different than anything that they have ever seen, that even the principalities and powers in heavenly places will learn something new. That's quite a thought. And this demonstration is to be made through the sealing. So now we can say that it is the need for the demonstration of the wisdom of God that comes through the sealing of the 144,000 that is holding things up in God's plan to finish the great controversy. So what is the wisdom of God? That's a pretty loaded question. Almost presumptuous. After all, who am I to be talking as though I understand the wisdom of God? Bear with me. Let's consider what we can learn by asking these four questions about this specific part of God's wisdom that is to be demonstrated to the principalities and powers of heavenly places by the church, by you and me. What plans are being held up? What wisdom of God could possibly require demonstration? What specifics need to be demonstrated? And can the sealing demonstrate what is needed? We're just going to walk our way through these in order. So our first question is, what plans are being held up? Well, the plans that we're talking about at the end that is to come. In other words, everything from the sealing on. Five big items stand out here. The close of probation, the time of Jacob's trouble, the second coming, the reward of the righteous, and the destruction of the wicked. Okay, now hold that thought. We're going to go to our second question right now. What wisdom of God could possibly require demonstration? Remember, this is for the benefit of the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. That's a loyal audience. Don't they trust him? Reward of the righteous, destruction of the wicked. Not coincidentally, those last two items on the list we just looked at come to mind. Satan has been complaining to God about his plans on these two issues for thousands of years. And the unfallen inhabitants of those heavenly places have a stake here as well. Remember, Lucifer was their commander-in-chief, their friend. Angels have very good reasons to make sure that God's plans, number one, don't endanger heaven, and number two, don't execute the wicked needlessly. So our third question. What specifics need to be demonstrated? Suppose a teacher gave a math test, and everyone flunked the math test, everyone. But suppose the teacher announced later that seven students would get passing grades anyway. You'd want to know what made the difference. Why those seven students get a passing grade, and if the teacher said, it's because they have blue eyes. I think you might think that was not fair. especially if you didn't have blue eyes. See, the problem is that blue eyes have nothing to do with math tests. It's just not a good reason. What would be a good reason? Well, maybe if the teacher gave the exam again and then took another test was taken. If the seven students that he picked out showed that they had learned how to do the math, that would make some more sense, okay? All right, another test is given. We change the slide. But no change. But doesn't the second test guarantee that they'll never again mess up another math question? Or is that really no better than blue eyes? Because they will mess up another math question. So does it sound like a good idea to take people to heaven? People like you and me. Even people who have passed a second test. What a risk. What a risk to heaven. And what about those who failed twice? What if the teacher gave them another chance? Give them another chance. Maybe they'll get better. Wouldn't they learn sometime? How many chances should someone get before the teacher says, it's hopeless, I give up, this student will never learn? And how can you say that when the consequence is not just failing a math test, but it's eternal death? Eternal death as the result. So back to our question. What specifics need to be demonstrated to justify his government's rulings on the reward of the righteous and the destruction of the wicked? God needs to do three things. He needs to show that there is a good reason why some are lost and some are saved. Remember, Satan is claiming that God's people have all sinned anyway. They are no more entitled to salvation than he is. If you're going to kick me out of heaven, kick them out too. Or better yet, he deserves salvation as much as they do. If you're going to take them to heaven, take me to heaven. Satan has some strong arguments here. He needs to show that the people he wants to take to heaven are safe to take there. That's a big issue. And this is the concern of the unfallen inhabitants of the universe about taking people like you and me into heaven, where we're liable to do the same things up there that we did down here. So the second point is the righteous need to be really saved. Really saved. And then he needs to show that there is nothing more that even God could do to help the wicked. In other words, is God being fair with those who are outside the city and will be lost? In other words, the wicked need to be completely lost without any questions about that. So, can the ceiling demonstrate what is needed? Probably no surprise to know that I believe that it can. So let's look at some basic information here. This is something we all have studied. The seal of God is contrasted with the mark of the beast. A seal, an official sign of authority, gives the essential information, usually name, title, and jurisdiction of the individual, organization, or government it represents. This information is found in the Sabbath commandment, name, Lord, title, creator, jurisdiction, heaven and earth. The mark of the beast is readily identified as the claim to have changed the Sabbath to Sunday, and finally a settling into the truth so that they cannot be moved. So far, so good. The Sabbath is the seal of God's government. Knowledgeable and determined opposition to God's authority in the form of Sunday exaltation is the mark of the beast. When God's people settle into the truth intellectually and spiritually so that nothing can move them, they will receive the seal of God. Now, the seal of God is placed in the foreheads of the 144,000 before the close of probation. The close of probation marks the end of Christ's work as high priest in the most holy place of the heavenly sanctuary. Sometimes we think of the seal of God as sort of a diploma or a mark of God's heavenly housekeeping seal of approval or something like that. But notice that the seal is given before the final test. Teachers don't do that. You don't hand out diplomas before you know whether or not the students have passed their finals. So what's going on here? This is not a diploma, a certificate of graduation. The conflict between the observance of the Sabbath and the mark of the beast reaches its peak during something called the time of Jacob's trouble. when those resisting the combined religious political authority of the world are condemned to death. And this is after the close of probation, after no people can change their minds, is what we're talking about. So the issue is all about Jacob. How did Jacob get into this trouble that is being referred to here? For thus saith the Lord, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with child. So why do I see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor, and all faces turned pale? Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. And it is the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. Now, Jeremiah, obviously, is the one who put Jacob's name on this occasion. He's clearly referring to that story that you know about Jacob's night of wrestling by the brook Jabbok, which comes from Genesis 32. The story, Jacob is returning home after his 20-year absence when he gets the word that his brother Esau is coming toward him with 400 armed men. And, of course, that's not a good sign. And realizing his only hope is in God, he spends the night praying, and at midnight, someone attacks him. He wasn't expecting that. He was praying for God's help. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And he said, you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. Notice what's happening here. The one he has been praying to is the same one he has been fighting. What does he believe? That God loves him and wishes him well, or that God hates him and wants him dead? It's faith versus sight and feeling and hearing and smelling and the taste of blood. It's faith versus all of that. Which is stronger? This is the basic test of the time of Jacob's trouble. Jacob is not the only illustration of this. Other stories add some other insights. We can only refer quickly to two of them. Under extraordinarily difficult circumstances, when it seemed to Job that God was out to kill him, still he maintained his trust and loyalty, and he said, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Interesting side note is that this whole test was Satan's idea, and God went along with it. And lest anyone think that this was an insignificant event, remember that it cost the lives of 100 people to set up this test for Job between God and Satan. But of course, the ultimate example is Jesus. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? All right. What makes this test special? Millions have faced death for their faith. What's the difference here? This is not the normal test of martyrdom. Because at this time, with no high priest in the sanctuary to intercede for them, the 144,000 feel no sense of God's abiding presence. Every sensory input tells them that God has become their enemy, just like Jacob felt. He's out to destroy them. In fact, listen to this. Those who live in the last days must pass through an experience similar to that of Jacob. Foes will be all around them, ready to condemn and destroy. Alarm and despair will seize them, for it appears to them, as to Jacob in his distress, that God himself has become an avenging enemy. After making every sacrifice imaginable to remain true to God's government, facing imminent death because they refuse to worship the beast and his image, and disobey God's commands, with no hope in anything but God, that's when God seems more like an enemy to them than a helper. And the question is very simple. Do they still trust him? like Job and like Jesus, do they still trust Him when it looks like they're going down and God is destroying them? Why such a test? Because it has to be the absolute most difficult test of faith possible ever under any circumstances. Nothing less can show that they trust God so much that they will do whatever it takes, even when it doesn't make any sense to them. And they think it's all going to be a big failure. Nothing less can show that they are, quote, saved enough to be safe in heaven. Before we go on with our line of thought, I can't resist just taking a moment to show how Ellen White describes the outcome of this test. Dangers thicken on every side, and it is difficult to fix the eye of faith upon the promises amidst the certain evidences of immediate destruction. But in the midst of revelry and violence, there falls upon the ear peal upon peal of the loudest thunder. God utters His voice from His holy habitation. The captivity of His people is turned. With sweet and subdued voices, they say to one another, God is our friend. Didn't look like it for a while. Isn't it great, though, that the hardest test of all time in 6,000 years of human history can be passed by any child who has learned Jesus loves me, this I know. Okay, back on our main track again. What does this test show? By placing His seal on the 144,000 before this most difficult of all tests, God provides convincing evidence that He can correctly identify those who are safe to let into heaven. He knows that they will not sin again. The seal, my friends, is not a diploma. It's not a graduation. It is a demonstration of God's wisdom that helps His loyal subjects feel a little better about allowing people like you and me to go to heaven. But it does more. Because everyone on earth at this time is familiar with this gospel. Remember, the true gospel, the real gospel. And only those who have faith pass the test, and all those who have faith pass the test. This test shows that faith is necessary for salvation, and faith plus a knowledge of this gospel is sufficient for complete, total obedience. This is why the gospel has to go to all the world. Remember, why does the gospel have to go to all the world? The test can't be carried out properly without simplifying the equation down to one variable. Only when the question of knowledge is standardized, everyone knows the gospel now, can the role of faith be clearly seen. It's a little like working on a car. You don't do a major engine overhaul and change brands of gasoline at the same time. Your car's performance might change, but you wouldn't know which caused it. So you have to stick with one variable, and that variable is faith. Who has faith and who doesn't have faith? Now, why is all this important? Apart from proving that the 144,000 are safe to let into heaven, big thing right there, this demonstration just happens to be exactly what is needed to take care of that one group that got left out of the whole story. Remember? The righteous dead. What about the ones who died and didn't come to this experience? Let's use a great hero to illustrate this. Martin Luther. Martin Luther didn't keep the Sabbath, even though he was told that it was important. Martin Luther was all confused on infant baptism. Martin Luther lived on roast beef, sauerkraut, and beer. And he was not the most patient of individuals. But he had faith. Now Jesus says, I can teach Martin Luther the details of this gospel when I get him to heaven. But the investigative judgment has already found that he had true faith. He trusted me. Is it okay with everyone if I take him home with me? And there won't be a single voice raise an objection, because righteousness really is by faith. By faith. It always has been. It always will be. Do we trust God in what He tells us? See, here's the point. Martin Luther's faith allows him to be saved, even with an incomplete knowledge of God and his plan of redemption. And he surely had an incomplete knowledge. But something more than what Martin Luther did is necessary before all of Satan's arguments can be cast down. He could be saved, but he can't vindicate God. So what is necessary now? All heaven is waiting to hear us, you and me, vindicate God's law. And my friends, they will wait until that happens. I don't even want to think about how long it could be that they have to wait. Already we've been waiting 120 years beyond the time when God planned. All heaven is waiting. If there ever was a people in need of constantly increasing light from heaven, it is the people that in this time of peril God has called to vindicate his character before the world. The honor of the law of God is to be vindicated before the unfallen worlds, before the heavenly universe, and before the fallen world. Now let's look at this carefully. The final test is not about my salvation, but about the vindication of God's law and his character, which are exactly the same. It is God that is really being examined here. Is his law a good law? Is God really handling a foolproof way to protect the universe from sin ever happening again? And so, again, notice the future direction of these statements. This is not about stage two and what happened at the cross. This is about us and the people that live at the end of time. And notice that this vindication demands increasing light from heaven. Because God can only be vindicated by pure truth, never by honest untruths about his law and character. Martin Luther lived in a time of limited light and told untruths about God's law and character, thus could not vindicate God completely. Martin Luther's faith was sufficient to save him, but insufficient for the final vindication of God and his law. That's what needs to be done yet. And here we have us. All heaven is waiting. This last test is not about our salvation, although that's involved. The last test is to answer all the remaining questions that Satan has posed and fallen and unfallen worlds have somewhat believed. The remnant of Revelation 12 was not called into existence to repeat the mission of Martin Luther or John Wesley or Billy Graham. It was called to vindicate God's way of accepting and rejecting sinful men and women. Is God's way fair to all, and will it protect the universe from repeating the whole sorry mess? The unfallen worlds, the heavenly universe, and the fallen world. So, what the test shows. God is fair in saving people with limited light on the basis of their faith. The sealed final generation shows that true faith will lead to obedience to complete light when it is available. Therefore, those who died with limited light will not jeopardize the safety of the universe because their genuine faith will always respond in obedience to new light when it comes to them. So, my friends, the ultimate mission of the last prophetic church is not to be saved, or even to help others to be saved, although both of those goals will be achieved. The mission of this church is to annihilate Satan's last remaining objections against God, his character, his law, and his method of saving sinners. That's what this church was called into existence to do. We are here as God's final piece of evidence necessary to end the experiment of sin and preserve the universe from sin ever arising in the future. Only then can Satan be banned even from tempting other worlds. We are here for a totally, totally unique purpose, never before seen in 6,000 years of human history, to show that faith will always lead to total obedience because God's way is right. We're almost done, but not quite done. Fast forward 1,000 years. After a thorough examination of the books of record, to answer every question about why this one or that one is not among the redeemed, the time has come to finish sin and sinners forever. You know the story. Jesus descends on the Mount of Olives. The earth splits right there to create a great plain. The New Jerusalem comes to rest. The wicked are raised to life. And after a period of unknown duration during which they prepare their weapons and they organize their forces, they are ready to attack the city. And here we go. At last, the order to advance is given, and the countless host moves on. An army such as was never summoned by earthly conquerors, such as the combined forces of all ages since war began on earth could never equal. Satan, the mightiest of warriors, leads the van, and his angels unite their forces for this final struggle. Kings and warriors are in his train, and the multitudes follow in vast companies, each under its appointed leader. With military precision, the serried ranks advance over the earth's broken and uneven surface to the city of God. By command of Jesus, the gates of the New Jerusalem are closed, and the armies of Satan surround the city and make ready for the onset. Up to this point, I don't know of any reason by which God has shown that to the universe that it is absolutely impossible to reclaim those who have rejected faith. Like the little old lady down the street who grew pretty roses and gave cookies to the children, but never accepted Christ. The book of record shows a lot, but isn't there some way to reach her even then? Just one more chance? Wouldn't you ask? Wouldn't you care? Would Jesus, the one who is the same yesterday and today and forever, the one who said, "Whoever comes to me, I will by no means cast out," the one who has no pleasure in the death of the wicked, would Jesus let a repentant and trusting sinners in? So one more thing has to be demonstrated. As soon as the books of record are opened and the eye of Jesus looks upon the wicked, they are conscious of every sin which they have ever committed. They see just where their feet diverged from the path of purity and holiness, just how far pride and rebellion have carried them in the violation of the law of God. The seductive temptations which they encouraged by indulgence in sin, the blessings perverted, the messengers of God despised, the warnings rejected, the waves of mercy beaten back by the stubborn, unrepented heart, all appear as if written in letters of fire. Above the throne is revealed the cross, and like a panoramic view appear the scenes of Adam's temptation and fall, and the successive steps in the great plan of redemption. So this great panorama in the sky, and I don't imagine it's going to be quick. I imagine it's going to take maybe days to watch this whole thing. I don't know. In this panorama in the sky, every individual will see what God did to save him or her and what they did to reject him. It is now evident to all that the wages of sin is not noble independence and eternal life, but slavery, ruin, and death. All see that their exclusion from heaven is just. Those who have united with Satan see the total failure of his cause. Satan sees that his voluntary rebellion has unfitted him for heaven. His accusations against the mercy and justice of God are now silenced. And now Satan bows down and confesses the justice of his sentence. Every question of faith and error in the long-standing controversy has now been plain. God's wisdom His justice and His goodness stand fully vindicated. In all that multitude outside the city, not one can now be found who has faith in God's love. Not one. As the faithful 144,000 pass the hardest of all tests and show the power of faith, so the faithless wicked fail the test and show their total depravity. And the entire universe will finally see there is nothing more that God could do to save them. More time would not help. Miracles would not help. Additional demonstrations of love and patience will not help. Only then will that be clearly seen. Notwithstanding that, And now Satan bows down and confesses the justice of his sentence. Every question of truth and error in the long-standing controversy has now been made plain. God's wisdom, His justice, and His goodness stand fully vindicated. Notwithstanding that Satan has been constrained to acknowledge God's justice and to bow to the supremacy of Christ, his character remains unchanged. The spirit of rebellion, like a mighty torrent, again bursts forth. He rushes into the midst of his subjects and endeavors to inspire them with his own fury and arouse them to instant battle. But of all the countless millions whom he has allured into rebellion, there are none now to acknowledge his supremacy. His power is at an end. But notice, even after Satan bows down and confesses the justice of his senses, after that, he still rushes into his subjects to fire them up to destroy the city. My friends, do we realize the insanity of sin and the insanity of Satan? With this evidence before them, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess the justice and the righteousness of God. And finally, all that has to be demonstrated will be shown. It's time to end the conflict. Look to me and be saved, all you ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. I have sworn by myself, the word has gone out of my mouth in righteousness and shall not return, that to me every knee shall bow, every tongue shall take an oath. He shall say, surely in the Lord I have righteousness and strength. To him men shall come, and all shall be ashamed who are incensed against him. What do you think? Isn't it great that God has told us what to expect? There are no surprises. It's all been detailed. And we can know how we can be among those who are inside the city and not outside. Shouldn't be a mystery for anyone who reads the Bible as to what God's plan is and how we can be a part of that plan. The only question that matters for us is, do we have faith to believe that God's plan is working? Though he slay me, will I trust him? Do we trust God without questioning? Will we be on the inside of that city? I pray everyone here will be.